This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks to Georgia Public Broadcasting for hosting us today in their Atlanta studios. We've been down here examining a vibrant, changing community in Atlanta and in this hugely diverse state in the center of the New South. Like Sherman's bitter, brutal march that went straight through Georgia at the end of the Civil War, a march that set the stage in good and bad ways for what the next century would be like, anticipating the upheaval of Reconstruction, the Civil Rights Movement, which in many ways began down here in Atlanta and in Georgia, the Reagan Republican Revolution, which had important roots here, as did the first inklings of the rebirth of the Industrial South. Nope. You can't get to the 21st century in America without following a path through the great state of Georgia. And let's get right to it. Welcome our first guest, the senior senator from Georgia, Saxby Chambliss. Senator, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you, and thanks for being in Atlanta.
Absolutely. Greetings from all your friends down here. Senator Chambliss, you are the vice chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. My first question relates to the news of Edward Snowden apparently getting political asylum or asylum of some kind in Russia, bearing in mind the sentence for Private Manning this week. How do you regard Edward Snowden right now?
I'm a little bit surprised that that Russia is being as receptive to asylum for Snowden as apparently they may be. It will certainly damage our already tenuous relationship with the Russians. You've got the president going to the G8 meeting and in Russia in September, and I suspect it will be a very frosty meeting if, in fact, Snowden is granted any sort of asylum in Russia. What they need to do is what we would do, send him back to where he came from and let justice take its normal course. But so far, obviously, we haven't seen that.
Well, Snowden has certainly produced some frost, interesting choice of words, in the U.S.-Russian relationship. It's also changed the debate about the National Security Agency, the NSA, on Capitol Hill, and particularly in your committee and in the Judiciary Committee. How would you assess the sense of backlash among lawmakers for what the NSA now reportedly does online, watching us all?
I think that lawmakers are starting to understand more and more every day, John, that what Mr. Snowden has alleged that he can do, he simply can't do. When he said that he could sit at a computer and access your email, read all your emails if he knew your address, he couldn't do that. That he could listen to your phone calls if he knew your cell phone number. There's no way he could do that. This program has been in existence for several years now, and it's provided valuable information with respect to the disruption of terrorist attacks. It's gathering what we call metadata, which is kind of a strange-sounding word, but the program simply gathers information that can only be accessed, John, with a court order and under a what we call a reasonable, articulable suspicion that the individual who uses that telephone number is a terrorist. And it's only that that data is not shared across the government. It is stored and is accessed only by NSA and only under court supervision, under DOJ supervision, as well as under Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence oversight. So I think our members are understanding it a little bit more because, frankly, I thought the Amash Amendment last week was probably going to prevail. But at the end of the day, it didn't because the folks, I think, are starting to understand that we have disrupted terrorist attacks against the United States over 50 times, 13 of which have been inside the United States by utilization of this program. And it doesn't invade folks' privacy. It doesn't invade their space. It's simply the collection of data that is accessed only in times when a terrorist attack may be in the works.
Although, Senator, we suspect that the House will go back at the NSA at some point, and the Judiciary Committee is taking a look at the NSA. Members of your committee will be meeting with folks at the White House. Is there any sense in which you believe that, regardless of your sort of general authorization for what the NSA has done, that there's been an abuse of the Fourth Amendment? Would you change anything about what's being done?
Well, I'm so familiar with this program because we've been briefed on it over the years, both as a member of the committee and now over the last 3 years as a vice chairman. I'm briefed on it regularly, and I know what the program does. And we are meeting at the White House this afternoon and with other members of the intelligence community to look at some transparency that we can put into the program now that it's not a secret or covert program. Perhaps we can make some changes to it that will be an improvement to the program. But the one thing we have to make sure of is that we don't eliminate the program as the Amash Amendment would have done. And there are reasonable changes in most every program that we operate here in the federal government, whether they're at NSA or at the SEC. We constantly review the programs and make necessary changes, and that's what we're going to do with this program. And perhaps we do need to make it more transparent so people can better understand that their privacy is not being invaded and that the program is valuable and the program works to disrupt terrorist activity.
As a senior Republican in the Senate and someone known for bipartisanship, let me ask you, and also someone who's known for discretion, let me push you on this. The X Key Score program, which was published in 32 pages of Snowden's leaked documents by The Guardian and is now widely available, really seems to show that the NSA has a digital tool that allows it to do almost anything in terms of monitoring people's browsing. Did you learn of the X Key Score program from The Guardian, from Edward Snowden, or from a briefing in the Intelligence Committee?
No, I've known about the X Key Score program. Again, it's a very sensitive program, and therefore it's well known to the intelligence committees. And again, we monitor that program, but that program is not as portrayed by The Guardian, and I assume they're getting their information from both from Snowden as well as from the documents. And if you examine the documents that have been published, it doesn't pretend to allow access to private phone numbers or private emails in the way that Mr. Snowden and the Guardian article portrays it to be. So, you know, it is a program that is not utilized in a way like the 215 program and the 702 program that we previously have talked about. But again, it's been a valuable tool for us, and now bad guys know how we can access their information. They're changing their ways. It's going to be harder for us to interrupt and disrupt terrorist activity because of these revelations. But the revelations themselves, I think, validate the fact, when you really dig down into the weeds of it, that we're not invading anyone's privacy and that we don't have the capability of looking at personal emails or listening in on personal calls.
We're talking with Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss of Georgia. Let's shift gears for a moment here. Someone you know well, a columnist in Atlanta, Jim Galloway, suggests that as a retiring two-term senator, your views, your sense of leadership in the Senate is really absent from the Republican primary field. Seven Republicans who appear to be chasing an increasingly right-wing and fringe constituency. Has the GOP in Georgia given up on centrism and bipartisanship, in your view?
Well, I certainly hope not, because whoever takes my place, and at the end of the day, John, I'm confident that the best candidate will prevail. Whoever that is going to find out right quick that the way you get things done in the Senate is to work across the aisle to get the 60 votes you need to engage with not only conservative Republicans, but with Democrats, too, to try to solve problems. Our country's got just a myriad of issues that are staring us in the face, and you're not going to solve them with just Republican ideas, particularly when we're in the minority, and that we don't have a patent on all the good ideas. So I think the Senate tends to moderate people somewhat, and I just hope that all of the Republican candidates just don't dig their heels in and back themselves into a corner where they get to a point that they cannot be reasonable and cannot reach across the aisle, and I don't think that will happen.
And end up turning Georgia into a blue state by 2016.
Well, it could. Yeah,
it could. Well, there's some news. There's some news. Senator Saxby Chambliss, thanks so much.
Okay, good to be with you, John. Take care.
Senator Saxby Chambliss, senior senator from the state of Georgia, joining us now from Washington, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, react to Senator Chambliss there on the NSA issue, on his notion that Georgia might become a blue state. That's pretty interesting. And it's August 1st, dog days of Congress, right?
Yeah, Congress is getting set to go out, John, for the August recess, and there's some interesting things coming up in the fall. But on what Senator Chambliss had to say about the NSA, what is interesting, and he and a group of seven other lawmakers are meeting with the president today on this, is what kind of moves lawmakers are going to demand in the fall that they take to rein in the NSA a little bit. Now, you heard the vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee there, who's a proponent of these programs, kind of talking them up. But there are going to be moves, apparently, to, one, the FISA court, potentially appoint an advocate. One thing that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have a problem with, John, is that the FISA court is not adversarial. The government makes its case, the judge rules, and a lot of people think that court is a rubber stamp. Some people want to appoint an advocate to make that process adversarial, like a real courtroom.
A kind of ombudsman for the Fourth Amendment or for the citizenry who can't really petition here.
A solicitor general, if you want, for those very issues, to make that adversarial like a regular courtroom. Also, potentially to declassify some FISA rulings, to rein in who at the NSA exactly has the authority to search those databases. We don't know exactly where a reform package will go, but all of these things will be debated, and I suspect many of them will come up with the president today.
Do you think Georgia is in play for 2016? He seemed to suggest it might be.
I detected a little bit of sarcasm in the Republican senator's voice there, but who knows, John? Who knows?
And in terms of between now and September 1st, is the Congress going to do any cliffhangers for us, or just setting up for the fall cliffhangers?
Just the fall cliffhangers. Look, John, there was a development last night in the House that flew under the radar that's very, very telling. A transportation HUD appropriations bill. Boring, right? Housing and urban development on the House floor. Here's the thing. House Republicans yanked it off the floor. It's their bill. It's their budget. What does that all mean? It means this when I boil it down for you. Remember the famous Ryan budget? Republicans, we want to cut domestic programs, no new taxes. They're operating under the Ryan budget. John, they couldn't pass their own domestic spending bill under their own budget. It really means that Republicans are completely divided in the House over how to handle sequestration and where to go on spending. When those spending levels from the magical Ryan budget hit the road, they can't pass the bill. What are they going to do in the fall when it comes to a government shutdown? That's the cliffhanger.
Well, we've got all of August to think about that. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
To the Middle East now, is there a trend towards stability in the nation of Iraq? It depends on who you talk to. The Iraqi government has been stuck in a political stalemate since the U.S. ended its formal military role in that country, but still, things are considerably better than was the case in 2006. On the streets of Baghdad, though, not so much. According to the United Nations mission in Iraq, 1,057 Iraqis were killed and another 2,326 injured in July alone, and that includes cities outside of Baghdad as well, making last month the deadliest since April of 2008. Jane Araf, reporter in Baghdad for Al Jazeera English and the Christian Science Monitor, joins me now. Jane, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Is there an organized sense of this violence? Is it more a lapse into chaos? And are particular classes of citizens being targeted, do you think?
Well, it's a lot of factors overlapping in a particularly horrible way. You're absolutely right that things are better than they were when there was no government, when there were no security forces, when police ran away. It isn't that. But what it is a combination of different factors. You've got Al-Qaeda that has undergone a resurgence since they were driven out of the cities, largely by U.S. forces working with Sunni tribes. And there are all sorts of other groups, including former Baathists. There's political violence. There is, as you mentioned, a political paralysis. And there's an Iraqi military security forces that just aren't very good at that intelligence effort that you need to crack down on these networks. At first, it was just Shias being targeted for the most part, because that has been one of the aims of al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Islamic State of Iraq, to restart sectarian war. But now it's a lot wider. It's Sunni mosques, Sunni neighborhoods, cafes, funerals, football fields, almost anything you can think of, and pretty much almost any time of the day or night.
We've all been holding our breaths, I think, since the story of that dramatic prison break where so many al-Qaeda suspects and individuals held in Abu Ghraib were freed. And I'm wondering if there's any sense of where these individuals have gone and if it's resulted in some resurgence in the underground networks of violent insurgencies.
Well, it's bound to have an effect. You just can't have a couple of hundred prisoners freed, particularly prisoners who had been serving time for being members of al-Qaeda, being operatives, being involved in bombings. But I think it's probably not quite at the point that Iraqi officials have raised the alarm bells for. Some Iraqi officials have said 100 of them have crossed the border and are fighting in Syria. Others have said that the escaped prisoners were partly responsible for a string of bombings last week. The thought is it's just too soon for that to happen. These bombings take a lot of planning, as do other operations. But still, it is extremely alarming, not just because of the escapees. Interpol, the international law enforcement agency, has put out a regional alert. It calls the prison break a major threat to global security. So there's the fact that you have these escaped prisoners, but it's also what it says about Iraqi security. This was a prison, Abu Ghraib prison, the notorious prison, where prisoners routinely have cell phones, as they do in every other jail. You can bribe a guard into almost anything. And the government response after this was to fire the head of prisons and to arrest many of the guards who it said were actually helping the prisoners escape. So all in all, pretty troubling.
I alluded to the political sort of deep freeze that the Iraqi government has been in for years. For progress to happen on the ground and in the security situation, does there need to be a movement to the next real political moment in Iraq right now?
There absolutely does, because while Iraq probably is not at the brink of civil war, I mean, it's just a different country than it was a few years ago. By the same token, nothing's really moving forward. It's sort of one step forward, two steps back. And there are a lot of things that should be moving forward. This country is one of the fastest growing economies right now in the region. It has immense amounts of oil revenue, even though the pipelines are again targeted by fighters and bombings. But that isn't trickling down. There are no jobs being created. The schools aren't much better. Here in Baghdad, the electricity is still cut off for 3 hours at a time. It's sweltering hot. There isn't even enough electricity for government employees to go to work 5 days a week. They're getting Thursdays off during this part of the summer. So it's not in great shape. And part of that is because there's so much political infighting. It's not just sectarian Sunni against Shia. There's also the Kurdish struggle going on, struggle for power between the Kurds in the north, where they have their own semi-autonomous region, and the Iraqi central government. It's essentially a country that's still being invented. Everything is at play. How much power they have in the provinces, pretty much everything.
How much of a sense is there that the diaspora, the considerable Iraqi diaspora since the U.S. invasion, might be a key to this reinvention, that when they start returning, when they start having an influence, that some of the issues of prosperity, security, and political viability will start to improve?
That's such a great question. That is a dream that a lot of Iraqis have given up on. And that is one of the more tragic things, and what essentially is still a very tragic story. All of those Iraqis who left with their hearts broken. I mean, the Iraqis who left didn't want to leave. This is their country. Iraqis, by and large, love their country. They left because they were driven out of their neighborhoods, or they had family members killed, or they couldn't stand the corruption. Things would have to get a lot better for them to come back. You're not seeing people coming back. Instead, you're seeing the opposite. If you go to the Baghdad airport, you will still see families clutching plastic bags with refugee documents. Absolutely heartbreaking, but people are still trying to leave. In fact, with this increase in violence and the increase in sectarian tension, there are more people trying to leave now than ever. And that comes at a time when it's harder for Iraqis to get out. So the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers, all those people who could help here, they're either not here or they're unable to help. And those who are out certainly don't seem willing to come back.
Jane Araf, reporter in Baghdad for Al Jazeera English and the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a human story of an Iraqi going against that heartbreaking trend Jane spoke about, coming home to a very changed land of his birth. We're here in Atlanta at the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Some Outkast for you there. We're going to play some Georgia favorites all this hour. Later in the hour, humans have been struggling with monogamy for all of civilization. Some new science suggests it is men who originally benefited most from a single mate. What do you think? This is The Takeaway. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Our refugee story today comes from troubled Iraq in the voice of a brave man fighting the trend Jane Araf was just referring to. Of the estimated 2 million refugees who have fled Iraq since the start of the U.S. war in 2003, and even more leaving today, as you heard, there is also a steady stream of people coming home. Amr Sadoun al-Maliki is one of them. Even though he became an Australian citizen while in exile, he is also a citizen of Refugee Nation, which is what we're calling the 45 million displaced people around the world. Today, Amr is a field officer for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. His job is to welcome his fellow brave Iraqis back. He returned in 2010 after a long journey.
When I left my country, it was a real danger, like a civil war and unknown people. They attack people who work with the NGO and coalition forces. But when I came back, it was totally different. It was much secure and much better, and there was no civil war. I felt much better than when I left my country. It's much better than before.
Amr, what would you say that you've lost as a person being a refugee for all these years along with your family? What have you lost?
First, I've lost my family because I left them more than 6 years here in Iraq, and I haven't seen them. Even I have part of my family, they left Iraq and they went to Sweden, and they're still living there. And I haven't seen my brother for more than 10 years. And also, when I left Iraq, I left my job and my position and my house. So I lost a lot when I left.
And today you're in Basra, yes?
Yes. Today I'm speaking with you in the center of Basra.
And Basra is a city that has seen so much violence and so much war going all the way back to the Iran-Iraq war. Do you feel hope for Basra today?
Actually, yes. At the beginning, we had very big hope after 2003. But for what happened with the civil war, we lost the hope. But when my family called me and they told me to come back because the situation better, the security is good, and there is a good opportunity. Actually, when I came back, I felt there is hope. And I'm sure the life is getting better for the job opportunity, for the life, for the development. And there is a big hope for all the people. That's why in my job, there are many returnees registered every week. They are returned from the overseas.
So what would you say to so many of the people that I've spoken with over the years who've given up on Iraq, who say there's no hope? What would you say to them?
Actually, I believe if there is no hope, there is no life. So always we believe in hope. I tell everyone to try to come back and see what is different. And everyone comes back to his country, for sure, at the beginning, will face difficulties. But after some time, when settle down, when get job, when get family back together, it's much better. So I'm saying, from Basra to every Iraqi outside, it's much better than before, and I hope everyone from outside Iraq coming back and see families and see the situation is better.
Amir, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Amir Sadoun al-Maliki is a former Iraqi refugee and currently a field officer at UNHCR Iraq. He spoke to us from the city of Basra. And now back in Atlanta, at the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, a story of secrecy and Georgia's death row. Under a new state law called the Lethal Injection Secrecy Act, the names of pharmacies that manufacture the chemicals used in a lethal injection are now kept secret from the public. Is a pharmacist who prepares such chemicals the same as an executioner? Should pharmacists be shielded from the moral and political debate over the death penalty? That question has already delayed one execution in this state. Warren Lee Hill, on death row since 1991, was granted a stay last month, just one of two stays he was granted in the month of July because of questions around the lethal injection he's to receive. Claire Sims, reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting, has been covering this story. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
What was the original intent of the secrecy law, and how has it conflicted or become a legal issue in the Warren Lee Hill case?
Well, here's the thing. We've seen this across the country. States are having a hard time getting the lethal injection drug because companies just really don't want the backlash, or they say they don't want their product used for executions. So they've had to turn to compounding pharmacies. Well, because they now don't want to have a problem finding compounding pharmacies, the state says we need to shield the identities of these compounding pharmacies and anybody who might be involved in the process so that we can continue to go forward with these executions.
And let's remind people, compounding pharmacies are pharmacies that are permitted and have been around for forever, permitted to actually make drugs and make solutions of drugs, often custom fitted to patients, in this case to inmates on death row. And so this is a way of keeping an incentive for them to be a part of the program without having the political backlash. What does the judge say in this case?
Well, this is being debated right now in the Fulton County Superior Court. And the judge there, basically, she hasn't ruled anything yet. She hasn't decided anything. She's just said, okay, this might have some merits and we should continue to go forward and hear the arguments in this case. So we still have a little ways to go.
Is the issue a kind of open meetings law that there has to be public disclosure of all this sort of thing? Or is it something to do with the pharmacists and the actual obtaining of the lethal injection drug itself, as far as you can tell?
Well, it depends on who you ask, obviously. You know, his attorney says this is an Eighth Amendment issue. Eighth Amendment protects you from cruel and unusual punishment. He says because the state is saying we're not going to give you information about where this drug came from, who prepared it, anything about their credentials, they're saying, you know, there's a likelihood or even just a possibility that the person who prepared this might not be the most qualified, that the lab that it was prepared in might not be the most sanitary or might have some sort of problems. And they point exactly to, you know, some of the issues that we've heard of with compounding pharmacies across the country.
And there have been issues not associated with death row, but issues of contamination and problems there. Now, people viewing the Warren Lee Hill case might view this as something of a technicality in terms of the circumstances of him being on death row. But what's the likelihood that this could open up a whole class of death row issues that would circulate nationally and we would see in other states besides Georgia?
Well, South Dakota has a very similar statute. They just passed it in 2013, just like we did here in Georgia. Theirs has not been challenged yet because they haven't set any executions. So that, you know, they'll be watching what happens here in Georgia. This is a state law, though. So really what happens here in Georgia might not necessarily impact some of the other states. The really interesting thing, though, is what the state wants is they want the Georgia Supreme Court to go ahead and hear this. They're afraid that if the Fulton County Superior Court has the deciding voice here, that every time there's someone up for execution, that this is going to become an issue. And they want the Supreme Court to go ahead and say, okay, this is either fine or it's not.
Finally, before we go, if the supply of drug goes away somehow because pharmacists don't want to get involved, does the execution business shut down in the state of Georgia and everywhere else?
That's what the state's afraid of. They're not sure what their next option will be. And that's why they've put this law in place to protect that as much as they can.
A death penalty case here in the state of Georgia, which may have implications around the country. Claire Sims, reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's a long-standing mystery. Why are so few mammals monogamous? It's a huge deal among humans, of course, having a lifelong single mate, but it's extremely rare among mammals except for some higher-order primates. What was the evolutionary pathway to monogamy, as imperfectly as we have arrived there? Two studies published this week suggest something of an answer. While we might think of monogamy as all about women demanding loyalty from the roaming, shall we say, Anthony Weiner-like proclivities of men, these studies suggest that men might need monogamy more from an evolutionary context. You may have seen some of the interesting discussions online after these studies were published. One study in the journal Science suggested that a small number of available females among early primates encouraged males to select a single mate and maintain loyalty as a survival mechanism. And a study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences argues that males are imprinted to be monogamous as a response to the threat of infanticide by staying near their mother after birth. That conclusion came from analyzing the behavior patterns of more than 200 primates. Kit Opie is an evolutionary anthropologist at the University College in London, was lead author on that study, joins me now. Kit, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi.
So males seem to benefit, or in evolutionary terms, based on this data, males seem to directly benefit from monogamy more than females, based on what you're seeing?
It's not so much that they benefit more. It's just that we wanted to explain why it was that primates were so different from the pattern that you've just described in mammals. And the threat to infants is from rival males who might kill the infant. And then that, of course, would be a disaster for both the parents. At least the female knows that the infant is hers. So in instances where the male is pretty sure that the infant is his, it's clearly in his interests then to provide protection for them.
And what behaviors do you see in monogamous primate relationships that protect the young males and then are passed along to the next generation?
Well, what we found is, as you said, that there's an evolutionary pathway here. So from, first of all, infanticide evolving during primate evolution, then we see monogamy arising. And then following that, we see males getting involved in the care of their infants. So as well as protecting them from rival males, they're also carrying them, providing them with cleaning, grooming, and so on. And of course, in the case of humans, actually providing them with food.
So there is a direct evolutionary pathway from the roaming mammalian male who finds mates wherever he can to the protective fatherly male all the way to the sensitive kind of doing the housework, cleaning and grooming male that you might see in a sensitive male household in West London?
That's what we think we've seen taking place a number of times across the primate order. Yes, there are a number of instances where we've seen this switch, and before the switch takes place, we think that the primates were in what we call multi-male, multi-female groups, where there would have been a lot of promiscuous sex. So, for example, in chimpanzees and bonobos today, that's exactly what we see, is that the female also, in order to protect the infant from infanticide, is having sex with all of the males within that group. So then when the infant arrives, all of the males have got some kind of idea that that infant might be his, and therefore he's kind of mildly protective towards him, but does absolutely nothing else towards that infant at all. And the female does all the care and brings up that infant. And yes, from that situation, then we see it's the infanticide that is the crucial question. And in those circumstances, a male who is the father of the infant sticks around and looks after the infant for the first period when the infant is particularly vulnerable. And what we find is that this is in large-brained species within primates. And obviously that's why we think it's different from other mammals, because primates are typically larger brained than other mammals.
So it's Anthony Weiner's chimpanzee brain that may be encouraging to behave in such a wretched manner. What surprised you, based on what you thought about going into this, about the results that you got?
Well, that they were so strong. That we didn't find any transitions to monogamy without the infanticide already have evolved in these various species, these various places where monogamy did evolve. We were testing three possible proposals for how monogamy had arisen. Either it was because of males caring for infants straight off, or that males were looking after females and protecting them from rival males and stopping the rival males mating with them, or infanticide. And we thought, you know, it's a kind of we weren't sure which one of those was likely to be right. And the results were absolutely clear that it was infanticide every time that was the crucial issue. But then once infanticide had got monogamy to kick in, then we saw all the flowering of male involvement, and of course in humans, it goes further in terms of actually providing them with food. But there are lots of monogamous primates around the world, particularly in South America, that are providing all the kind of typical features of paternal care that you would imagine: grooming, cleaning, carrying, all that kind of stuff. It is pretty sweet. So although it may not have been the most romantic reason why monogamy started in the first place, I think there's a kind of silver lining that afterwards those males are being pretty caring for those infants.
Well, it's fascinating. Kit Opie is an evolutionary anthropologist at University College in London. What do you think? Does monogamy benefit men or women? Do you have an evolutionary pathway either out of monogamy or towards it? We'd love to know what you think. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention. Dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
So let's carry this monogamy discussion into the human realm, shall we? How do you find a relationship today? Here's one way. Listen.
This is John Kern from Apopka, Florida. And I believe the family is the basis of human society. So I am monogamous in order to have a strong family to create strong members of society.
But have some of you out there evolved to using online dating as a way of having a relationship? Listen to this.
The world has changed. One in five relationships now begin on an online dating site.
Oh, hi!
There's only one place to go, Match.com. We've led to more dates, more relationships, and more marriages than any other site. Begin something new today.
How are you? Nice to meet you.
More dates, more relationships, more marriages? Is that monogamy they're talking about or something else? What is it for humans? Who gets the better deal in monogamy? Is it men or women? Here to talk about that, Lamar Tyler, who's a married father of four kids, co-author of BlackAndMarriedWithKids.com, right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Lamar, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Emily Rems, managing editor for Bust Magazine in the studios up there at WNYC in New York. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So let's quiz you right at the top. Lamar, who gets the better deal out of monogamy? Is it men or women in your view?
Well, personally, I can just speak for myself. You know, what monogamy allows me to express my love, you know, to my wife, not just for her, but for the children and the world as well. And she's really, through this monogamous relationship, our marriage that we have, she's really propelled me to new heights.
So you've benefited or she's benefited? Both is not an answer here.
Well, in this situation, I'll definitely say, and I think she would say, I'd say I would definitely have benefited the most out of it.
All right. Emily Rems, what do you think? Men or women benefit most from monogamy?
I think ultimately both benefit. But in the very beginning, in a place like New York, where I was dating primarily before I settled down with my partner, there's a lot more women than men. And the men are kind of treating the dating scene as an all-you-can-eat buffet, whereas many of the women that I've come in contact with, certainly not all, sort of go along with the open, non-monogamous situation just to try to play along with the men that they're interested in. But in reality, there's a certain security that women are looking for that takes some time to get to with men. And they benefit once they're able to achieve that.
Well, one of the scientific studies that was published this week suggests that in a situation where there is a low supply of females, and in the human community that exists actually today in places like China and India, where there is a relative shortage of, of mates compared to the number of men that are out there, that encourages a certain amount of monogamy. You're saying in New York, where there seems to be an oversupply of available women, that encourages, at least initially, some different kinds of behaviors. Am I getting that right, Emily?
Yes, that's basically what I'm saying, that there's a lot of non-monogamy, but it's at the beginning stages of relationships, but that's not always what's most desirable to the women involved.
Lamar, looking at you, I mean, did you date originally in the Atlanta area?
Well, I'm originally from the D.C. area, but yeah, definitely dated. I didn't get married until I was maybe 27. I think it was 27 when I got married, so I definitely dated.
So when you were in that sort of crucial period in your 20s in the D.C. area, how did the environment there encourage either monogamous behavior or something else?
Well, I don't think culture as a whole, this environment that we live in today, either supports or encourages monogamy. You know, from what you, the songs you listen to on the radio, from the shows you see on television. So I really think it's a personal choice. And for me, even at that time, it was a personal choice with girlfriends that I had to be in monogamous relationships. So I think it's really something that depends on that person. But like one of the earlier callers said that called in, I think really family is the cornerstone of not just our culture, but of our community and our country. So it's something we definitely need to focus on more.
So the cultural message is non-monogamy. That's the way of expressing your maleness or your femaleness. But if you want to actually survive, you've got to be monogamous. Do I have it right with what you've learned, Lamar, in your life?
Well, I definitely think that's what culture supports. Like I said, when you look up on TV or the songs, everything's about hooking up. Everything's about, just having fun for that night. It was a big saying last year, YOLO, you only live once, YOLO, right? And there's so many songs and just different references to that type of living. But when you talk to married couples like we do on our website or through our films, what you find out a lot of times from men is they were taught and told, okay, sleep with as many women as you can sleep with, have as much fun. And when you get married, when you settle down, you lose something. But when you talk to men who are in good marriages, you find out it's just the opposite. When they actually got married, they didn't lose anything. They actually gained a lot.
Emily, is the cultural message at odds with the survival mechanism of actually having a stable life in a stable single partner relationship?
I think so. When you're talking about non-monogamous relationships, at least from my own experience, jealousy, abandonment issues, competitiveness, resentment, these are all things that I felt were commonplace in my own emotional landscape when I was trying to play the field. And
so you were miserable, is what you're saying.
You know, I was trying not to be, but I find myself a lot happier when I'm not worried about those things, when I know that I'm there for my partner and my partner is there for me, and when there's leisure time or downtime or all that precious free time that we need so badly but don't have enough of in New York, that I know that my partner is going to be spending that time with me and I'm going to be spending that time with him and I don't have to compete for it.
Well, one of the mind-boggling things, and I'd love your commentary on this, and Emily, you're more in touch with the kind of teen world than I am, even though I do have two teenagers, and Lamar, I'd love your thoughts on this. Well, all the cultural messages that drive me crazy as a dad about, sexuality and do what you want and we only live once and live for today, all those messages that you've described, my two 15-year-olds are in these steady boyfriend relationships. One has been in a relationship for 6 months, and you know, I can't imagine them breaking up. And my other 15-year-old has been in a relationship for 2 years. I can't believe it. I don't know what to do. They're reacting to something. Emily, do you know what's going on there?
I'm sure in some regard they're reacting to the fairy tale aspect of popular culture. You know, there's the hookup aspect of like going to Duck Club or whatever. But there's also the fairy tale aspect of popular culture that you get in TV and movies where they kiss and then they're together and they're in love. And that's certainly something that young women aspire to when they're just starting out dating. They want to try out the happily ever after scenario and see how it fits for them. So I'm not surprised that that's the case, but I would possibly be more surprised if they're still with those people in another 2 years or
so. Yeah, me too. Lamar, final thought for us, and then we got to go.
Yeah, just along those lines, you know, just I have three young daughters myself, and I worry about what happens when they get to that stage. So with me, I'm just thinking about having those conversations and letting them know that that guy they're in love with when they're 16 probably won't end up being their husband. But still, just impressing upon them and letting them see through me and my wife what a monogamous relationship brings to the table.
All right, Lamar Tyler, married father of four kids, co-author of the website blackandmarriedwithkids.com. Emily Rems, managing editor for Bust Magazine. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
What's your take on monogamy?
This is Jackie from Orlando, Florida, and I am in a five-year monogamous relationship that we opened up for a short time about 2 years ago, and we barely survived.
Portland says something very different. Monogamy is not for me. One of you says, I've been married twice for 10 years. Each time, love dies. We'd love your take. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And speaking of monogamy, we want to take a moment to send a hearty congratulations to Takeaway producer Jillian Weinberger, who marries Alex Levitoff this weekend, and our former digital editor Alex Johnson, who wed his girlfriend Rachel Molitor earlier this week. Later this fall, producer Mithley Rao marries Jay Davies, a Takeaway team that's very pro-monogamy, so it seems. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from Georgia Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.